Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at your income taxes with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband David have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals, they consult other tax professionals, and they teach tax seminars around the country. So as we talk with Mary, what questions do you have about filing your taxes? Join in. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Mary Mellum, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Larry. It's nice to be here.
You know, the last 2 years, we've been given extra time to file our returns. Is that going to happen this year?
As at this point, no. But the filing deadline is April 18th this year because the 15th is a holiday in D.C., and that would mean the 16th would be on a Saturday, Sunday's the 17th. So that brings it out for the individual to have an April 18th individual deadline.
I like to file as early as I can. How early can you file?
The IRS has opened up for, or is opening up for, electronic filing this coming Monday.
Oh, okay. So that's good. I know there have been reports of people still waiting for last year's refund. How can you avoid doing that or having that issue?
Well, there's a couple of big reasons that caused problems with last year's delay, one of them being the stimulus payments. And one of the things that people need to know is the amount of stimulus payment they received that is reconciled on this year's tax return. So far, we've had, during the pandemic, three different stimulus payments. One of them we refer to as the $1,200 payment. The next one was a $600 payment. And the third one was a $1,400 payment. The 12 and 6 were reconciled last year. And this year, it's the $1,400 payment that needs to be reconciled. And some people would tell, as a practitioner, some of people would say, no, I didn't get it. And then if you reported that on the tax return, that would say they had extra money coming. And if the IRS said, no, we mailed it to you, that held up the return. And so knowing exactly how much that $1,400 payment was to that filer is important. And the IRS is helping people out this year. If people remember, they sent out letters, some of them after the fact, that said, we sent you, or we deposited, or you received one of those little gift cards with your stimulus payment on it. And we encourage people to keep those letters. But the IRS is concerned about people losing the letters, so they are sending a form, a letter 6475, to taxpayers. They theoretically were starting at the end of December, and I don't know where they are in that process. But I strongly encourage people to look for letters from the IRS regarding the amount of stimulus payment that they have been paid this year, and to report that properly on the tax return. That doesn't mean it's taxable. It means that it is reconcilable with the credit that is listed on this year's tax return.
Okay. Let's talk about the child tax credit for a minute. I know some parents have already received some of that money. How complicated is it going to be when they file this year?
I think that the child tax credit is going to take over the number one issue problem for the IRS this year. And that, again, is because there is a child tax credit with expanded numbers and expanded rules. And the IRS or Congress decided to help people, stimulate, if you will. They sent an advanced credit out starting in July of 2021. And the advanced credit was sent out, and it's basically what you would have received based on your prior tax return and the number of children that were on the prior tax return, and their age was advanced, so it would be the proper age, so not to be sending the wrong people the wrong money. But they did decide to base it on that information, which may not be correct for this year, but they did make those advanced payments, and they would have gotten a payment for each month from July through December that reflected basically half of the child tax credit that they would be getting for the year. Again, it's a reconcilable issue that says, how much tax credit do you deserve this year? How much did we already pay you? You will get the balance of it on your tax return. With that, there's a host of problems that could occur. And on top of it, if you got more than you deserved, there is a potential that you may have to pay it back. And the IRS has produced the form. It's a Schedule 8812 that does take into consideration all of what I've just said.
Wow. Okay, so it could be head-scratching time for some people this year on their tax forms. Patrick in Green Bay has a question for you that I think kind of relates to this. Patrick, hi.
Hi there. So I did my taxes last year, and I did them on TurboTax. They were both declined by federal and state. Tried going through some stuff on the IRS website to get back into my taxes to correct them. They wanted my adjusted gross income from the year before. Well, I enter that. It says it's the wrong number. And I guess my question is, what do I need to bring to an actual tax professional to get this all corrected, and what kind of fees or anything else am I looking at?
Okay, let's start with the first part first. Based on what you said, if your return was rejected, does that mean that you did not file it last year?
Yes, I guess so, yeah.
Okay, so A, number one, you're going to be starting over filing 2020's return. Have you received any government correspondence relating to 2020's return?
No.
Okay, well, that's good. Then I would strongly recommend all of the documents that you had taken last year, or, you know, had used to prepare it, that you get all of that stuff together. And the first thing that you need to do is file the 2020 return. And it is going to take a while. The only reason I can think that the IRS hasn't contacted you yet is because possibly you have money coming back, and unless you had a tax due, possibly, that would be how they would say, you know, you haven't filed. So I strongly encourage you to get to someone as quickly as possible, and I would strongly suggest that if you have a copy of the 2019 return, that you bring that along with you so the practitioner has somewhere to start. As far as the fees, it all depends on who you go to see. That all fees with different practitioners are different. So I can't really give you a ballpark figure.
Yeah. You'd want to go to somebody who's got some experience. That's for sure. This is a little more complex, perhaps, than just, figuring out your taxes for this year.
The figuring out the tax part, depending on your situation, is a normal part. But because it's being filed late, chances are there's going to be correspondence between you and the IRS, and that's another part of it that also adds to the picture.
Okay. Patrick, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Vivian in Dykesville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, Larry. Good morning. Yeah, I had a weird situation when I filed our 2020 taxes, and I do it myself with TurboTax. And I filed the 2020 taxes, and everything was fine. Everything was accepted. I always owe money. So about, I guess, towards the latter part of last year, I received a letter from the IRS saying that I incorrectly claimed that I didn't receive the second stimulus payment, that, you know, the $600 per person, so $1,200 for us. Well, it turns out we did receive it, but we didn't receive it until within 2021. So, of course, I wasn't going to claim it on the 2020 tax return. Well, now they have since, you know, then they said, well, I owed $1,300 plus penalties. So I don't understand why they made that determination when, in fact, it wasn't paid to us until 2021.
Vivian, I can answer that question for you easily. When the IRS set up the recovery rebate credit, which was a credit that you had to reconcile on your tax return, they set it up based on the money as it was issued or set up. And in the instructions to the recovery rebate credit, it asked you how much of the $1,200 first payment, how much of the second payment did you receive? And that's why the problem. This year, it's also going to create a problem because people like yourself are going to think, I need to report the $600 and the $1,400 this year, when in fact, that's not the way it is. So it was the first two payments because those were the two that started in 2020. And 2021's tax bill is when the others were. So it's just the way the government set it up. But you had to follow their direction, and that's why it is tied up. Now, you can ask for relief of the penalty for it, but the IRS does not have to grant that relief. So when you pay your tax bill, it theoretically was due April, I guess it was May this past year. And that the interest would start from that point. So don't be surprised if they will not forego that interest or penalty.
There you go, Vivian. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional from Green Bay. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. You can join in with your questions. We've got open lines to get you on pretty quickly. The number is 800-642-1234 or email us. The email address, ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your taxes today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Mellum, tax professional. With she and her husband, David, actually operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. They're enrolled agents, work out of Green Bay. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. Keith in Dunn County emailed. He's not been deducting the cost of his Medicare premiums on Wisconsin taxes. Schedule SB Line 6. He assumed this was not allowed because Medicare premiums are paid from the Social Security benefit and Social Security is not taxed in Wisconsin. Recently, a friend told him he's mistaken, and as credible as his friend is, he thought he'd consult a higher power, you. So what do you think?
Well, I know that's confusing as far as the Social Security not being taxable, but your friend gave you good information. And the Medicare premiums and any other health insurance, which includes dental and vision as well, is deductible on the Wisconsin return. Now, The good news for Keith is that Wisconsin has a four-year statute of limitation. So if you so choose and it makes enough difference, you certainly could go back and amend those prior returns and claim that deduction.
Ah, so there you go. Your friend was right, Keith. Joe in Chippewa Falls emailed to say he's now on disability and is wondering if that's taxable.
Good question, Joe. It depends on the kind of disability that you're talking about. If you're talking about Social Security disability, it follows the same rules as Social Security itself. If your income is high, enough, using the formula for determining taxability of it, up to 85% of the payment could be included in your income. If it is disability payments that you are receiving from an employer, they generally are taxable. If they are disability payments in the nature of workman's comp is not taxable. And if it is a disability policy that you took out through an insurance company and you're paying the premiums on the disability or had paid the premiums, then that generally is not taxable. So the answer is, it depends.
Okay. Steve in Wausau, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. Just a question regarding my son was is working in Arizona, and he's moving, and he's forwarding all his mail to my house from a post office box. And I got one the other day, Department of the Treasury, Internal Revenue Service, Kansas City, Missouri. And I thought, oh, I better open this just to make sure that it's something that he doesn't need to do immediately. And I read it, and I said, well, why didn't I get one? And what it says is, we assigned you an identity protection personal identification number and important information about filing your 21 federal tax return. And my question is, why didn't I get one?
Well,
personal identification number.
Steve, I am so happy you brought up that question. It's excellent. The IRS has an identity PIN, ID PIN program that when people's identity has been compromised and the IRS has been notified, IRS sometimes issues an ID PIN to those people. Every year, they will get that letter with a new number for each year. So it's very important that that information gets sent to your son before he files his tax return. Otherwise, he'll be going the reject route like the gentleman earlier had told us about. The reason you do not have one is because either your identity has not been compromised or potentially compromised to the point where IRS issued you one, or you did not voluntarily ask for one. IRS has opened up the program. This is relatively new, that people can voluntarily ask for an IP PIN, and it's Identification Protection PIN. It is a 6-digit number that when you ask for it, IRS will issue it, and it applies to any IRS electronically filed information that you send to them, whether it's this year's return, last year's return, whatever it is. So the reason you don't have one is because you haven't needed one so far and you haven't asked specifically for it.
That is good information because, the number of people kind of getting scammed on this has increased significantly. So I kind of like that idea, Mary.
Now, there's one other thing I want to mention. Wisconsin has started a program that you can ask for an ID protection number or ID protection I don't want to totally call it number, because in the federal number is a six-digit number. The state number is a combination of letters and numbers, and I believe it is a seven-digit identification number, and it ends with W. So if you're concerned about it for Wisconsin, you can voluntarily ask for that from them. And again, these things you can go on either to the IRS website or to the Wisconsin Department of Revenue website and plug in the words identification protection PIN or ID PIN, and you will find information and how to apply for those.
Well, it sounds like John in Milwaukee has a related question here. Let's go there. John, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I also was a victim of identity theft in late September of last year. Went through all of the rigmarole to close down everything. But the people who did this opened a number of accounts in my name, investment account, checking account, savings account, tried to get all of those accounts closed. But now I've received a couple of letters from, you know, the pro forma letter saying, yes, your tax information is on the way. So I'm wondering if these people stole my money and it was in an account that was interest bearing of some fashion or another. What do I do if there are tax implications?
Okay. I think that's another great question. I think an ID protection PIN is an excellent thing for you to ask for, but there is one step I would do before I go to that, and the IRS probably will send you one without you even having to ask for it. The IRS has a form 14057, I believe is the form number, and that number is one that you would fill out to tell the IRS that you have been a victim of identity theft. And with that being said, that when you fill that out and tell them the circumstances, they probably will ask you already or will grant you that IP PIN, so that when your tax return comes in, that, I gave you the wrong number. It's 14039. Yes. 14039 is called an identity theft affidavit. You can get it by typing that number in at the IRS website and filling it out and telling them the circumstances of why you feel that your situation has been compromised. And with that and a little bit of work, if you are receiving 1099s in your name that are not yours, you would be telling the IRS that, and then you would not be charged with that interest or those documents. And it's not just interest documents. Some people have done it with workman's comp and applied for benefits in other people's names, and they don't realize it until they get a strange form that isn't anything that that they applied for.
Wow.
So get that form, fill it out, send it to the IRS as soon. In the instructions that accompany that form, you will see the proper way to get it to the IRS as soon as possible. I also assume that you have contacted your local law enforcement and reported these kinds of things.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and the FBI,
yeah.
And the FTC.
Yep. So just let the IRS in on it by using that form, and eventually things will get straightened out.
John, good luck. Thank you so much. Sorry for those problems. Diane in Baldwin, your turn now. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a couple questions. I came here in May. I didn't establish residency till a couple of months later. At what point, How do you file taxes if you're, is it part-time resident? I moved here from California.
Good question, Diane. Do you intend to be a Wisconsin resident?
I have been. I moved here. I should be at this point.
Okay. Wisconsin, and the answer to your question, just a quick overview of the answer. The answer to your question is that when you move from one state to the other, you're a part-year resident of the one state that you came from until such point as you become a resident of the other state. And so you would be filing a part-year California return and what we call a 1NPR as a Wisconsin non-resident return. And it would be for the part of the year that you were a Wisconsin resident. A lot of people do it based on intent. So if I moved out of California on May 31st and I moved to Wisconsin with the intent of being here, up to May 31st is California, up to from then on is Wisconsin, and that's how you divide your income. If you moved here and you weren't sure that you were going to stay here, that date might be different from that. And Wisconsin looks at things about when did you rent a property, when did you get a driver's license, when did you get a fishing license, you know, what indications are that you want to be a Wisconsin resident.
Got
and
it.
That's how it's decided.
Diane, thank you. Good luck. Appreciate it. Karen in Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, my grandchildren were in foster care for part of the year in 2019, and I was taking them every weekend, and then when COVID hit, I was taking them 4 days a week, and then in August, I got full-time guardianship of them, and so...
August of 2020?
August of 2019.
Okay.
Okay. So... when we went to do our taxes last year, we claimed them, obviously, because the CPA said, how many days did you have them? I said, 250-some days. And he said, then you need to claim them. Well, the other family, for some reason, claimed one of them instead of both of them. They claimed one of them for some reason. And unbeknownst to us, we filed our taxes later, didn't know that they did that, and we were told to claim both of them, so we did. And we got our tax returns, you know, back about 8 months later, but then I got a letter, and it just said, was it true that you had these two kids, you know? And I said, yes, yeah. So I didn't hear anything more about that, but I'm just wondering... am I in trouble for doing that, or?
First of all, Karen, what you have to look at is the timing. Since they are your grandchildren, you potentially could claim them as qualifying children. They have to live with you more than half the year as their primary residence. The fact that there were foster care people, you know, did the foster care, is there any document that took them from one to the other? What I would recommend for you is to look into the documentation. Is there anything that says, you know, that they're wards of the courts and the foster system? And also, I would put together... a calendar of how long they actually lived with you having the right for them to live there.
Okay.
And, you know, it may be that the IRS had enough from what you sent back to them that you won't be bothered by it again. And if not, then you'll have the documents together to prove why you see them as having lived with you for more than half the year.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it might be the other people who would have some problems that claimed that one of the individuals, one of the kids. Karen, thank you. Good luck. I hope that helped. By the way, we have some open lines to get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Roger in Glidden, Wisconsin. Roger, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm driving into a forest phone area, so if you lose me, that'll be the end of it. But my question was in regard to deducting your medical expense. Is it 7.5% of your gross or your adjusted gross? And can you deduct all of your premiums, like your dental, plus the dental bills and your medical? We had Marketplace for our health care coverage until I had to get away from that to be on Medicare, but then the wife had to be on the government healthcare.gov until she is going to be in this coming up year on Medicare. But my main concern is what can you deduct? How much? I believe it's 7.5%, but of what?
Is it the gross or the adjusted? Okay.
Another good question, Roger. It is 7.5% of the adjusted gross income. With that, it is a Schedule A deduction, so you not only have to meet the 7.5%, but once you meet that together with your other itemized deductions has to be more than the standard deduction, which to get any benefit of that on the federal. The state still has the 7.5% number, but the state goes together to form an itemized deduction credit. So you might get it on one, you might not get it on the other. Your medical premiums all go into that number for federal purposes. For state purposes, you get an automatic deduction of your health care premiums, the Medicare, the health insurance, including dental and vision. And that's taken away from the number to produce the itemized deduction credit because you can't have it in two places on the state. So 7.5 is the key number for the basic question that you asked.
There you go, Roger. Thank you so much. The adjusted gross income.
One thing that I do want to mention about what Roger said, Roger mentioned Marketplace insurance. And back in 2010, we had the Affordable Care Act, which changed health insurance a great deal and made it available to buy through the marketplace with government subsidies attached for certain people. When you are doing a tax return and you have marketplace insurance, the marketplace will send the taxpayer a form 1095A, that you need to reconcile with the amount, to include the amount that you received as premium assistance. And you may, based on your income, have to pay some of it back, or based on your income, you may have a credit coming because of that marketplace insurance. And this year, we have some differing rules with the marketplace insurance. So if you are someone who is dealing with marketplace insurance, pay attention to the changes in rules that might affect you.
Good points. Patty and Willard, we'll go to you now. Hi, Patty.
Yes, hello. I wanted to know a little bit about the credentials of tax preparers. I mean, there's free computer service, free AARP services. There are regular tax preparers that pop up around tax time and then disappear. And then I guess there's CPAs. What kind of credentials does everybody have to have? And how do you know when you need something more, a more of a specialist? And I'll listen off the air.
Thank you.
Sounds wonderful. Thanks for asking that question, Patty, because that is a confusing question to people. Let me address some of the free things or the AARP or VITA programs. Those are free programs, voluntary people that do things as a public service. Generally, the people there have had some tax training. Some of them might be in college towns. They might be students, accounting students in some cases, or people with ideas of wanting to go into that profession that have been trained in a, I would say, a minimal amount to handle the tax returns. And they're usually selective about how in-depth they're able to handle the tax returns. Then you move up to the next level of your tax preparers, and those without particular credentials, it varies on what you have. Some people are seasonal people that have a minimal amount of education that are able to handle certain things and maybe aren't able to handle certain kinds of returns. There are people who have chosen not to have credentials that are very reputable, very educated people that can handle it. There are other people that, and I'm going to use the term Circular 230, because there are tax professionals that are governed under Circular 230, which is a program through the government that allows those particular people who are under Circular 230 to be able to represent people before the IRS when they have particular tax issues. Generally, the people under Circular 230 are the people that you're talking about. Circular 230 covers enrolled agents, CPAs, and attorneys. Of those three broad areas, the only one that is a tax specialist is an enrolled agent. And to be an enrolled agent, you have to pass a three-part exam given by the IRS, and that is a one-time test that is strictly based on taxes. It covers a gamut of individual business taxes, estates, gifts, and ethics. And once you have passed this exam, each year you have to take certain classes. You have to take a minimum of 16 credit hours per year, 72 over a three-year period, to keep that credential. CPAs can also be tax experts, but I caution people, and I don't want to step on anybody's toes, there are CPAs that are tax specialists. They don't take the EA exam. They take a CPA exam, which covers a variety of things, not just tax. But some have chosen to focus on tax. And again, that is a very reputable area. Some CPAs have chosen not to focus on tax, and that's not, if you're looking for a tax specialist, that might not be the right thing. Again, with a CPA, you need to ask, what's your area of expertise? Are you a tax person? Are you an audit specialist? Are you, you know, in the profit and loss area rather than tax? And then attorneys, again, with attorneys, you have tax attorneys, and you have attorneys that choose other areas. So I guess you have to know what you're looking for. Fees probably go up, I used to jokingly say, based on the number of letters behind your name. To some extent, that's true. But again, if you're looking for someone and you're feeling that you want to have someone who is, I would say, a full-time person, the credentialed area is the best way to go. But that doesn't mean people without credentials aren't good at what they do. So the best thing to do is find someone you're comfortable with, ask what they can do for me, ask them what your background is, and make your decision based on that.
Hmm. Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay. She and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, and they are enrolled agents. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your taxes on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Mellum. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and are enrolled agents. We have lots of callers online, lots of emails. Phoebe in Fitchburg emailed with something relating to what you were just talking about, I think, Mary. She wants to ask what she should expect from a reputable CPA firm when they make a mistake. She will pay whatever the correct tax liability is, of course, but what about the following associated with the CPA's mistake, the penalty, the interest, and or the CPA's time to file an amended return?
That's a good question, and the question depends on the firm itself. Each firm or each tax professional decides where they are in that situation, and I've seen all the way around it. Generally, first of all, the tax is never paid by the tax professional because the tax, if it had been done correctly, you would have owed the tax anyway. So some pay interest and penalties, some do not, some charge to have things fixed, some fix whatever has been the situation. So it's hard to say, and it depends on each person separately. There is no rule that says what you have to do.
Bob in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Hello. I have a question about Free File. I have been using TurboTax Free File for the last few years, and I got an email from them recently saying they are not going to participate anymore. And I'm just wondering if there is a recommendation as to what my other options are or what your thoughts are on that.
Okay. Bob, this is a tough question for me, first of all, because as a practitioner, I don't have any experience with any of those programs. As a practitioner, we all have our software that we purchase to do the tax returns that we're compensated for. I am aware that they are that the company you mentioned is no longer part of the Free File program. I believe that the IRS has about eight different people or eight different associations that are still doing the Free File program. And so I encourage you to go to the IRS and take a look at those places. I cannot tell you if one is better than the other. What you might do if you want to solicit any opinions, you know, people on some of the media forums are willing to share their experiences and their ideas, and you probably get a better answer from them about what they personally have used than me, because I know that a program needs to do certain things. I would hope any that are sanctioned or offered through the IRS website do the minimum necessary to file a return. But whether it's easy to work with or not easy to work with, I have no idea.
There you go, Bob. Thank you. Lucille in Menominee, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Lucille.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I have a question. What is the threshold that you do not need to file taxes, federal and state?
Federal-wise, the threshold is the standard deduction for your filing status. So you would have to know the filing status. If you're single, that happens to be, or married separate, it's $12,550. For married filing joint, it's $25,100. Unless if you're older and or blind, there's extra amounts that get added on for that. Head of household is $18,850. The state, again, is somewhere in, you know, state has its own set of numbers, and off the top of my head, I don't have the state numbers, but where you can find the filing information is go to the Wisconsin Department of Revenue, and they have a chart in their instructions or right on their website that will tell you exactly what it is. If it is another state that you're involved in beside Wisconsin, again, their Department of Revenues will tell you the filing requirements for a resident. And I can tell you for the state of Wisconsin, if you are a non-resident and you have income in Wisconsin, that's a $2,000 threshold.
Mm.
So all depends on where you are and your filing status, but the information is very easily attainable for state.
I'm thinking about the state for a minute, Mary. Might it be useful to file anyway, because even if you don't need to, because there might be some credits back to you in one form or another?
I think that's a great thing to think about as far as filing. Let's look at federal for just a minute. This year, because of the child tax credit, there is a potential that you need to file to reconcile that tax credit. Because of that advanced money, people need to file a tax return, even if they're under the filing requirements, if they've gotten the money, to reconcile that. The same is true if they've gotten the health insurance or the stimulus payment. It is possible the stimulus payment, if you got more than you deserved, is not an issue. But if you did not get the stimulus payment for one reason or another, you have to file a tax return to get what you didn't get. And certainly things like earned income credit, and this year, child care credit is a refundable credit. So if you don't file and they are refundable credits, you won't be eligible. On the Wisconsin, we also have the homestead credit. That is another credit that is a refundable credit that you need to file regardless to get that. So it's important to look into all of those things to make sure that you're getting the best deal for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So it might pay, Lucille, to file anyway, even if you aren't, you wouldn't have to. Tom emailed to say he's tried several times but has not been successful in setting up an email with the IRA. Where does he get directions on, and who can help him set one up?
I guess I'm a little confused.
Now that I'm reading it, I'm confused too. I'm not quite sure. He may not have an email address. Maybe we can get a little more direction on that later.
But I think his question brings up a comment, something I'd like to say, and I'm not sure exactly where he was going with it. But there are three letters that taxpayers can get this year or that might be coming to them. We've talked about the stimulus letter that tells you how much your stimulus payment was so you can reconcile it. We talked about the IPPIN letter that you need for filing. And there is a third letter that is coming from the IRS for those people that got the advanced child tax credit. That letter is a 6419. All of those things you need to properly file your tax return if you have those letters coming. If you don't get those letters or have thrown them away, the IRS does have the ability for people to go and set up an account through the IRS and be able to get those numbers or letters through that account. It is an online account, and the acronym ID.me is what you might see to set up that account. So if you should have had those letters and you don't have them, it would be good to go to take a look at the IRS website and set up this account so that you can go and find that information directly from the IRS before you file your tax return and get caught up in the delays that the IRS is telling people now are going to happen.
Our guest today, Mary Mellum, she'll be with us right up until 12:30 today to talk about your taxes. She and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your taxes today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Mary Mellum. She and her husband, David, are enrolled agents, and they've been in the tax business for more than 30 years at Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. So it's great to have her with us. And join in with your questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a question from Emily in Madison next. Hi, Emily. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I have a moderately I'm filed by mail in February of 2021 for my 2020 taxes. I got a letter on January 13th of this year from the IRS that was dated as having been written on November 29th, which stated that they disputed a couple of the numbers in my, they listed three different things that they had an issue with, and they said that I owed a certain amount of money that I needed to pay back, and I needed to make the payment by December 20th. There are two concerns I have out of this. One is that it arrived 2.5 weeks after the date which they gave me for a due date. But the second is also because I'm self-employed and they disputed both the income that I claimed and the amount of certain credits that I could file. So I'm trying to figure out how that impacts my gross income, which I have to list in order to file electronically this year.
Because
all of my questions.
Okay. I think I understand what Emily's asking. The issue that they have challenged your return should not impact if they have accepted your return, and what they are doing is questioning it audit-wise, then you would use the gross income that you have listed on that tax return. If they have not accepted your return, that's a whole different situation. But as long as they've accepted the return that they filed is the gross income that they have on record at this point. And you still have the opportunity to challenge that issue by responding to the IRS. Unfortunately, it's going to take time because things are backed up at the IRS, and if you're responding to them by mail, going to take a while before they get the letter, and you're probably going to get nasty letters from the IRS saying that you owe this money, and you're just going to hope, you know, wait till the two get together. You certainly can try to contact the IRS. The record of being able to get a hold of the IRS is not overly
good.
Optimistic, yes. But those are your options. But if it is an accepted return that they are just challenging, not rejecting the return, then use the gross numbers that you had when you filed that return.
There you go, Emily. Thank you so much. Jim in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello, yes. I have a question. We had a rental property that we sold in 2021. We had bought it in 2012 for our daughter to live there when she was a student, and then subsequently rented it to various tenants. So my understanding is that we have to pay capital gains tax on the amount we sold it for minus the amount we paid for it, but we can also subtract for the
improvements.
Improvements, yeah. But we've seen a tax specialist, a CPA, and he said that while we owned it, we should have been taking depreciation every year, and I didn't know that, so I had never done that. And he says that now we need to decrease the amount that we say we paid for it by the amount that we should have that we should have previously claimed for depreciation. And so my question is that correct? It seems to me, since we didn't do the depreciation, since we didn't know we had to or didn't know we were supposed to, we shouldn't have to pretend that we did.
Fortunately, Jim, you spoke to someone who does know what's going on, and the advice, what he told you or what she told you, is exactly correct. The IRS says that depreciation is allowed or allowable, and ignorance to the tax law is not an excuse for not following it. So what he did tell you is correct, that when you report that, you have to decrease your basis by the amount of depreciation that was claimed or should have been claimed, whichever is greater. The only other thing that could impact you is there is a change of accounting method form, a 3115, that can be filled out, and you can request it's a change of accounting method that allows you to do catch-up depreciation. So there is a way to get benefit of that depreciation on the return for 2021 if it's done correctly. It is involved, and if you're having a tax professional do it, I strongly believe that you will be paying extra for this, but it is the way to get back the benefit that you're going to have to pay taxes on. So if you're, if you're so inclined, the advice he gave you was, the interpretation was exactly correct. But if you want to know more, you could go back and ask him, what about a Form 3115 change of accounting method for catch-up depreciation? That would be my recommendation to you.
All right. Good luck, Jim. Thank you for calling. Camille in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Camille.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a medical bill that I incurred at the end of 2021, even though it's just a moot point because I never make that standard deduction. I pay the bill in 2022. I just want to know whether it's part of my 2021 medical expenses or if it's part of my 2022 medical expenses.
The answer is the year that you paid the bill in, because most individuals are cash basis taxpayers, so the deduction would be the year you paid it, which is 2022, if I understood you correctly.
Yeah, makes sense. Good luck. Thank you, Camille. Ann in Green Bay, on to you now. Hi, Ann.
Hi, I have a similar incident to what Emily was previously speaking about. We received a notice from Wisconsin Revenue that we owed over $600 from a 2017 tax return. And we called multiple times and multiple different people asking for some clarification because nothing in the mailing said why. And it actually seemed like a scam. When we first got it, we're like, this is a total scam. We should throw this out. At any rate, every time we called and asked for clarification or asked for some form to be sent to say why we had received this, we got nothing. Finally, I spoke to someone who said, well, this isn't on the shoulders of Wisconsin Revenue. It's because the IRS informed us that you're now in a new tax bracket or some such thing. And again, anytime we asked for any clarification, we got nothing. Every single person that I talked to said they were going to send me something in the mail to clarify it. And to date, we have not really received anything that helped us make sense of why we had been audited by the federal government without knowing that we had been audited. And then why a 2017 return was coming in 2020 and 2021. And this would be like the second time, I think, that we've been audited, maybe even the third. And it also is just frustrating because we don't have a difficult, we're using standard deductions, using an online program. We don't have a difficult income or a high income. So it just feels like you're kind of getting stomped. So I'll just listen to your response. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sure. Let me first of all address the Wisconsin side of it and then talk about the whole issue in general. Wisconsin has a 4-year statute of limitation. And so they have 1 year beyond what the federal government has to go back on returns. So 2017 return filed in 18 would still be under the Department of Revenue's ability to audit. And so that's why 17 is open. Number two is that if the federal government audits a tax return and it changes a number, they automatically inform the state of Wisconsin about that audit. And if you had been audited by the federal government, you have, I believe it is up to 120 days now, and they just expanded that, I believe, from 90 to send in an amended return in response to that federal change. So those are all things from Wisconsin's side. Now, it appears because of the answer that you got that Wisconsin hasn't audited, and it was something that Wisconsin knew. Based on what they told you, it was a federal audit. Now, why? Going back to the federal side of it, if you were audited in 2017 return, and there was a change on the federal side, then you had an obligation to do whatever for the state if it required a state change. If you weren't audited in 2017, then maybe it is an identity issue that has prompted this. So I guess one of the things that I would do is look back at your records to see if there was any change on your 17 return that maybe you've forgotten about with everything that's going on. Having a simple return doesn't mean you can't be audited. When the IRS decides if there's something wrong with a return, it's because they look at the data that has been sent in to them, the 1099s, the W-2s, and they compare it with the tax return. And generally, it used to take about 2 years for that cross-section to happen and then people be notified. In the days of better computer access, that time frame has been shortened. So if nothing else, go back and see if you can talk to someone, and I know this is a tough time with IRS to get a hold of anybody, but that's what it's it's going back, you know, that's what it potentially is going back to based on what you've been told.
Hmm. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Chris in Milwaukee, will go to you next.
Oh, goodness. I hope that you can give me an answer. I took an extension on paying last year's taxes, and I did not realize that I did not have to take the extra money off of all of my IRAs because I didn't make them into Roth. I get a higher income now than when I was younger teaching, and I also get $17,000 that I pay tax on every year, even because a scoundrel annuitized an insurance company, found the annuity company to pay back every year, every month to hold that money. But as far as the IRS is concerned, I had earned that money every year, $17,000, and I pay a tax on that every year. Well, last year, I wouldn't have had to do that had I read the fine print on a letter that came that said you don't have to take because of the pandemic. So is there any chance of my getting that money refunded at this late date?
Okay.
Not exactly sure I understand all of what you're telling me about the $17,000 and the scoundrel company. But what they were talking about in the fine print of the letter is that because of pandemic relief, people were not required to take out their RMDs. If the IRS received a 1099-R with that $17,000 on it, in their mind, you've taken out your IRA, and there's no reason that they would give back the money based on something that they see. If there is a reason that you shouldn't have included that income, that's a whole different story from that, and that would be something that you'd have to discuss with them or challenge with them. But if you are taxed on that money for whatever reason, and there is a document, the IRS, in the IRS's eyes, you have received that money, and that's why it's on the tax return, and they're not going to give the money back for that reason.
Hmm. There you go, Chris. Thank you very much for calling, and good luck. Appreciate your call. And Jim and Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Jim.
Yes, my question is for a 2020 taxpayer that is eligible for the unemployment compensation deduction and has not heard a word from the IRS at this point. What procedures do they do? You can't call the IRS. They don't answer the phone, and they have not sent any letters.
Chances are you're not getting it. What you are talking about is that apparently you filed your tax return early in 2020 before the law changed, and if you received unemployment in 2020, there was a $10,200 exclusion of up to that much of your unemployment. For anyone that filed before the law came out, and I guess I'm talking more from professional filers, the IRS said, don't go back and amend it. We will fix it. They are in the process of fixing it, and they have not finished that process yet. So there are still people that IRS will be sending checks out to. Was your unemployment more than $10,200?
No.
Okay. Then I don't need to say any more about it. But if you have not, if you filed your tax return claiming all of the unemployment income, and you have not heard from the IRS yet, you are probably just down the list that they haven't gotten to you yet. So I would just be patient and keep it in mind that as time goes on, you can IRS does provide some information through their website, and I don't remember off the top what the keywords are to get there, but they do have a record of how many returns they're behind in processing, and I believe the unemployment and there were three issues, unemployment and the premium assistance credit, and I'm thinking one other thing, that they were working on. But just to give you an idea of where the IRS is, about a week ago, their information said that for the 2020 returns being processed, there are still 6 million 2020 returns that have not been processed yet.
Oh, boy. Oh, my goodness. There you go. Thank you so much for that call, Jim. Appreciate it. Terry emailed to ask when reporting online purchases, does she include just merchandise and tax paid, or does she include online subscriptions such as Amazon Prime, Hulu, online computer support, and that sort of thing?
I believe what she is talking about is the sales tax.
Yeah.
That when she's talking about reporting online purchases, I guess I'm not sure exactly what her question is. But if she is talking about the sales tax that she's not paying on online purchases, it is whatever is subject to sales tax that is not being charged by on that purchase. If she's asking about online purchases for some other reason, then I'm not exactly sure what it is she's reporting. But sales tax, if you do not pay sales tax, if you purchase something and you live in the state of Wisconsin and it is a sales taxable item, then Wisconsin has a line that you're supposed to calculate your sales tax equivalent and pay it to Wisconsin. A few years ago, there was a case called the Wayfarer case that said online merchants were supposed to charge sales tax. And so for the most part, we don't see as much of that as we did. I mean, there are little companies that maybe aren't abiding by that, but the Amazons and your big online retailers are pretty much charging sales tax.
Mary, on that note, we are out of time. You've done your usual wonderful job. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll look forward to another visit from you. Thanks, Mary.
You're welcome.
Mary Mellum, she and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals out of Green Bay. They're enrolled agents. Great to have her with us. Tomorrow, Jessica Walser is back with us on Garden Talk, and talk about attracting beneficial bugs to your garden. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.